The Recipes for Life podcast is a conversation about my favorite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed their health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com. Professor Timothy Noakes is a dear friend of mine. Professor Timothy Noakes started researching the effects of carbohydrates, proteins and fats on the human race. After his research convinced him that a high-fat, low-carb diet is the healthiest option for many, Professor Noakes founded the Noakes Foundation in 2012. After being left frustrated by a decline in his own personal health, Professor Noakes has made it his mission to reverse this global trend. The Noakes Foundation is the catalyst for this change. It seeks to reveal what genuine, healthy nutrition looks like, and in doing so, makes a difference in the lives of millions of people. To find out more about Tim Noakes and the Noakes Foundation, visit thenoakesfoundation.org. thenoakesfoundation.org. Tim, thanks so much for being a guest on our podcast today. And I just want to say thank you for all the work that you've been doing. You are a huge inspiration for not only me, but for so many people, not only in South Africa, but around the world. And the ripple effect for what you stand for and what you've been through is a testament to just a beautiful human being that you have changed so many people's lives. So I just wanted to start by acknowledging you and passing on my love and gratitude towards you, brother.
Thanks so much. Well, I return them to you for what you've done. It's no less important. So thank you very much for those kind words.
And thank you so much for allowing us to film your very public trial last year and featuring that in our documentary, The Magic Pill, because without that, I mean, the film would have been great without it, but being able to follow what happened to you and the persecution, and also for you to be able to present the evidence and for us to be able to use that into the film, it was great timing. And, I always look at trying to find the positive in any situation, and I just wanted to thank you for that too, because I know it was a very traumatic time for yourself and the family and for the movement as well, and there was a lot riding on the outcome. And I want to get into the trial a little bit later on, but for people that aren't aware, but I want to start by asking you, and for anybody that hasn't heard of Professor Tim Noakes, let's talk about your history and what you are qualified as, because you're pretty high up there, aren't you, brother?
So I left high school not knowing what I wanted to do. And then the famous South African surgeon, cardiac surgeon, Chris Bahana, did the world's first human heart transplant at the hospital in Cannes. And I decided that influenced me so much that I wanted to study medicine. I got into medicine and really realized very quickly that I was much more interested in science than in medical care. And so I had this dilemma that what was I going to do? So I did my internship, and then I definitely realized that I would rather write the book than learn the book, because that's kind of what medicine is. It's about learning so much information, most of which you'll probably never use. And I just can't do that. I've got to have information that I can use. So at the same time, I'd started running, and I'd become much more interested in the physiology of sport than the physiology of ill health, so to speak. And so I immediately went into research and did my doctorate in medicine. Then I qualified as a scientist. And then the University of Cape Town invited me to start the first sports science course and sports medicine course in South Africa. So I started that, and I worked doing that for close to 30-odd years. And then I had this Damascene moment when I learned that what I'd been teaching about diet was completely wrong.
Wow.
And so I had this problem. What do I do? Do I continue? Do I just continue to make people unhealthy by advising them to eat high-carb diets, as I had in my book, Law of Running? Or do I say, gosh, I got it wrong and change? And for me, there was no choice. I come from a family that my dad taught me honesty. He said, that's the first principle. So I knew I had to change.
What was that like for you as a professor, as someone that had all the research that you'd shared and accumulated in that one moment? What actually happened with your thought processes and your belief systems when that actually occurred to you? Like, was it instantaneous and you said, okay, I have to spread this new message? How did that unfold for you?
So what happened was, I went running one morning and I got home and I opened my emails, and there was an advert for this book, The New Atkins for the New You, written by three scientists who I really respected. And I was so angry because I thought they'd sold out to Atkins, that I went and bought the book and I read it, and I realized within 2 hours, oh my gosh, I got it all wrong. That there's this whole body of evidence in the low-carb movement of completely and utterly ignorant, despite the fact that I'm a sports scientist and I thought I knew a bit about nutrition. And I'd studied nutrition, obviously, for all these years. And so I decided to change. And within 6 weeks, my running had gone back 20 years. So I figured, well, this is pretty obvious that this is a good thing. But I was very scared to promote the idea in South Africa because I knew there'd be a huge backlash, as there was. And by then it was too late. I'd committed to this, and the profession decided to take me out because of it. And, you know, we'll come to that. But then I was too far gone. I couldn't now go back and say, actually, I'm now wrong twice, because I knew I was right. And I just knew we had to fight this one.
Because you applied the principles to your own lifestyle and that of your family? Or who was the instigator for this? Was it just N equals one being Tim Noakes?
Well, you know, it's funny because I converted my diet in 1976 when I was in medicine. I was studying with all these famous cardiologists, and they were saying, you know, you've got to eat margarine and you've got to cut the fat and you've got to eat pasta and rice and bread and potatoes and all that garbage, I should say. And my wife said, no, she's not interested. She wasn't going to eat the margarine. She continued to eat the butter. And under great duress, she used to cook me pasta. So for me, when I converted back, she said, well, thank goodness you've finally seen the light. So that was relatively easy.
I love it. And I guess the answer was in front of your nose the whole time.
Exactly, it was. And then, you know, it became so overwhelming because all the evidence was there if you only looked for it. And so that was my point, that it was an experiment of one. But by this time, I was receiving emails on a daily basis from hundreds of people saying how they'd benefit from this diet and thanking me for taking a stand. And so then I wrote a paper on, I took 127 of their reports that they'd written to me and analyzed them. Mm-hmm. And amongst them were three people who had reversed their type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
And I reported this in the South African Medical Journal. You'd think I dropped an atom bomb. I mean, the whole profession went ballistic, saying, this is not science. How can you trust these people? Well, one of them happened to be a general practitioner whom I met. And he confirmed that he'd reversed his type 2 diabetes and that he had thought he would be dead in a few years and told his wife as such. And here he was, amazingly healthy again. So, you know, you have to report that. I said specifically in that report that this is not a randomized controlled trial, but it should set up a randomized controlled trial because we need that to see whether we can reverse type 2 diabetes with this diet. And the resistance was astonishing. And then, of course, that led ultimately to the trial.
Well, let's talk about the resistance to this. And why do you think it's been such an atom bomb, as you say, to the profession and to the industry? Because things evolve, things progress. I mean, that's what a scientist does. They test things out, isn't it? Isn't that how it works? Like, you present a new evidence and you go, okay, let's actually have a look at this.
Well, that's how it used to be, but it's not like that anymore. Now there are no facts. It's what you believe and want to believe. And if the facts disagree with you, well, you just ignore the facts. And I mean, that's the postmodern world that we live in. And unfortunately, even in medicine, we're getting to the state where what you believe is independent of the facts. It's what you just, well, what your personal opinion is becomes the fact. So, and of course, I didn't realize that at the time. So what really happened was we wrote the book, The Real Meal Revolution, and we wrote it in 5 weeks. I mean, it was astonishing. I've never written a book so quickly. And it just went ballistic in South Africa. It sold 250,000 copies, which is something of a record in South Africa. We don't have a massive reading population. And all of a sudden, people were going to the dietitians and saying, but here, Noakes is saying that he reversed all his diabetes and all these people are reversing their diabetes on a high-fat diet. But you're telling me that a high-fat diet is going to kill me, and I don't understand. And the dietitians refused to answer that question. And so the public became very angry. And it's very clear that what they decided to do was to take me out, to stop the messenger. Rather than address the issue that actually we're not answering the public's questions, we'll just stop them asking the question. And very clear evidence that the then head of the Association of Dietitians of South Africa, Claire Yelsing-Stratum, was in collusion with the regulatory body, the Health Professional Council of South Africa, before I did anything that was deemed irregular. And so when I did tweet that infamous tweet, the most expensive tweet in history, because it cost this country $1.2 million
wow,
to sort the problem out. So it is the most expensive tweet in history that we know of. When I did that tweet, they used that as the excuse to charge me. And the goal was to shut up social media discussion of diet. That was the ultimate goal. And of course, there were many, many forces behind it, and there was commercial interest behind it as well. But the bottom line was there was collusion within the profession to try to shut me up.
You must have been aware of what's happened in the last 2 weeks in Australia as well with the dietitians or the DAA, as well as the breakfast cereal manufacturers, and the reports that have come out, basically a similar type of thing where they're in collusion to silence or discredit or to shut down voices like myself or people in your position, like Dr. Gary Fecky, who's a respected medical professional in Australia. So do you see this as a coincidence, or do you see this as a formulated attack and formulated strategy from these industries?
Oh, unquestionably formulated, you know, because one of the great supporters of me has been Greg Glassman, who started up CrossFit in the United States. And there were a couple of reasons why he was interested, because science has been distorted to try to discredit CrossFit, and they've been able to prove in court that this has happened. So Greg is an astonishing man. He's the first person in history who, when something bad was written about CrossFit, that CrossFit was getting, all these people were getting injured, he said, okay, we'll go to court. And I want to see every single person who was part of the trial, in other words, the subjects, I want the subjects in court because I want to speak to them and hear what they have to say. The first time that subjects in a research trial were called to court, a subpoena, it turned out that it was complete bogus, that these people either didn't exist or they weren't injured.
No way.
Yeah, you have to go and read it. It's cost him $12 million. To expose this fraud. And it hasn't ended yet because he's right on top of the whole story. And he will tell you that it is a global thing. So anyway, the point was he sent out his expert investigators to talk to me about this during the trial. And they worked out that the International Life Sciences Institute was intimately involved in my case. And the Institute for Life Sciences Institute, ILSI, is a Coca-Cola front. It's also a front for other organizations, but it's a Coca-Cola front. So that was, it seems to me that there was a sugar stroke cola bias against me that was probably being coordinated, and not just in South Africa. And it was very interesting, for example, that in the middle of the trial, or sorry, shortly before the trial began, the senior nutritionist at my university, one of them then became an expert helper to the prosecution. What? I mean, is that a coincidence? Mm. Or was that planned?
It's not a coincidence from anyone's point of view. So take us through the you got charged. Tell us about the charge and how this came to be.
So the charge was I was reported by Yelsing-Stratum from the Association of Dietitians of South Africa for tweeting advice that a mother and her babies, because it was mothers and babies, it wasn't a mother and a baby, that mothers and babies should perhaps be weaned onto the low-carb, high-fat diet. And I was charged with giving potentially dangerous advice, and therefore it was unprofessional conduct and not evidence-based. And so I was charged with unprofessional conduct, which is really interesting because unprofessional conduct usually is really bad stuff, that people really do bad things like rape their patients and steal their money and so on. But so I was being charged for a severed tweet that was suddenly unprofessional. Anyway, the court, we were in court for 26 days. As I've said, it cost 15 million South African rands to both the prosecution and to myself combined. Fortunately, it would have bankrupted me, but we had two of the best lawyers in South Africa who saw what was happening, and they came to my defense at no cost. So that was astonishing. And that cut my cost by 10 million rand, probably. And they were just two of the best. We had the best legal team in South Africa. And there was the opposition just had no hope once we got those guys going. So what I decided to do, and what my guys told me, Mike van der Nest, our senior counsel, he said, Tim, I want you to blind them with science. That's all I want you to do. And we did that, as you saw. We had 12 days of scientific evidence, which was never contested. And in fact, in the ruling, they didn't even discuss that really, the science, because there was nothing to contest. It was true. It was accepted. So we had our 28 days and I was declared innocent on 10 counts. Then we went back. They appealed it. They brought out a new committee. That's the Health Professional Council, which worried us because we were concerned that this new committee could be biased and they could be influenced. But fortunately, they were ruthlessly honest. And they gave their final decision on June the 8th. They're completely innocent of all charges. And the case was thrown out and the appeal was thrown out. The HPCSA had one more option. They could go to the High Court. Of course, that would cost even more. And we would have loved them to go to the High Court because we would have nailed them finally and we would have exposed the collusion behind the scenes. But they wisely chose not to. So that's the end of the case. And what it means for low-carb people globally is that never again can anyone be charged in a court for saying that they're for prescribing the low-carb diet on the grounds that it's dangerous. We've proved that it's not dangerous, that it's an option, a reasonable option for people with particularly insulin resistance. So in the end, that's what we achieve.
So I want to ask you this question. I mean, you've been through hell and back, basically, and your reputation has been put on the line and facing bankruptcy and all of this. How do you see it now? Do you now look back and see it as an opportunity? Do you see it as the perfect thing happening at the perfect point in time for you and for this message?
So, of course, my wife and I went through hell for 4 years because we were mobbed by my university and my faculty department. And mobbing is when the senior person in charge of the organization identifies an individual as no longer being part of the group. And wants to out them. And that's what the university did to me. And we didn't know what mobbing meant, but then there is an article, a scientific article we read. And mobbing can lead to suicide. And there are a number of cases reported globally of individual scientists who did something that was unacceptable to the mob. And they were mobbed, and ultimately they went and committed suicide as they saw that was the only way out. So no one ever tells you or is concerned when you get mobbed that actually the outcome can be suicide. But literally, that's how tough it is. So Marilyn and I went through a tough time, but we're tough. And we said, listen, we've just got to fight this thing tooth and nail. And we had such incredible support from our legal team that we just knew we're going to fight it and we're going to win. Having been through it now and having finally got the final verdict that I was completely innocent on all charges, when we talk now, my wife increasingly says it was worth it too. What we've achieved was worth it. And that's what I feel too. I think that this has drawn attention, as you showed in your film. It's drawn global attention to this case and the fact that this is what we're up against. We're up against an industry that is ruthless and has no interest in your health or my health. And people will eventually see it, and we will convert at least maybe not all the world, but the majority to see what we believe.
So obviously now the door is open, as you've said, that this was a pivotal or turning point for the future. So obviously you blinded them with science. Then how come this science isn't making it to the mainstream media, or is it? And is it happening slowly? And where do you think it's happening the most? Is it South Africa now because you've won this case? Is it Canada? Is it the United States? Is it, it's not Australia at the moment. Is it New Zealand? How's this movement going to take place? And because you are at the coalface here and with your colleagues are pushing hard, no doubt.
You know, I think we started and said, you know, one meal, we changed the world one person, one meal at a time. And I still believe that that's what's going to happen. It's going to be the general public that are going to change. What we do now in South Africa, that there's a Facebook page dedicated to low-carb eating, and it's got 1.5 million members in South Africa alone.
Wow.
Which is astonishing, because they didn't know what low-carbs were 3 years ago. And so that gives you an indication. I think that the young doctors are going to be important for the following reason. And I think, sorry, and I should say this, I think that the social media is critically important. You know, I worked with Bob Wilmer, who coached the South African cricket team for many years. And he said, Tim, you know, there's coaching before video analysis and on video analysis. He said that was the defining moment in coaching. And I think in this case, it's the social media that is the defining moment, that you had medicine before and you have medicine after the development of social media. And as you know, what happens is that people now go onto social media when something doesn't work for them, and they discover, my gosh, look at Pete Evans and all the people who've adopted his eating plan, and look how healthy he looks and look how healthy they look. I think I'm going to try it. So I don't mind that my doctor tells me this diet's going to kill me. I see so much evidence on social media that people are benefiting hugely from it, that I'm going to try it. What have I got to lose? You know, it's funny, but one of the first things I saw on Mark Sisson's blog, a guy who was really heavy, looked like about 100 kilograms overweight or 200 pounds overweight. And over the next year and a half, he looked like he became an international number 8 rugby football player. And I thought, no, that's not possible. You cannot change from that to that. And then I said, well, maybe you can. And I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe the stories that I was reading on Mark Sisson's page. And that convinced me that there is something in it, because I would have been taught as a medical doctor that obesity is an irreversible condition, like type 2 diabetes. And I've always believed that anecdotes are terribly important information, and you have to take them very seriously. Because if one person can do it, that means two people can do it, which means 10 people can do it, which means 10 million can do it if you finally understand it. So to answer your question, I think that a lot of countries are changing. South Africa is changing. There's still huge resistance here because we're a very, very conservative medical profession in South Africa. Mm-hmm. I think that financial problems are the real challenge to medicine. And I've been recently in Britain, and it seems to me, you know, they are so proud of the NHS in Britain, which has done such an amazing job for the British population. And they want to see it as the best medical service in the world, but it's being dragged down by the cost of diabetes. And I honestly think that they're going to change that, and they're going to start moving on diabetes and are going to institute low-carb diets as the treatment for obesity and diabetes. And once something as powerful as the NHS says this is the only way you can treat these patients, or this is the preferred way, I think things are going to change. I would add that Nina Teicholt, who's one of my great heroes and came out to the trial and was an expert witness, and by the way, she couldn't be cross-examined. The prosecution lawyer just was floored by all her evidence.
She's about great.
He threw in the towel and just said, Mrs. Teicholt, I hope you have a lovely time in Cape Town. And that was all he could say to her. For the viewers who don't know, she's the author of Big Fat Surprise, which is one of the most important books written in medicine in the last 50 years, I believe. So I know that she's working very hard in America to have it change that low-carb diets are an option. Then we're not saying they're the only option. We're saying they're an option. And her point is quite simple, that once you allow people, doctors, to prescribe the low-carb diet, the patients will find that they get better on the diet and it's easier to follow than other diets, and it will become the preferred diet. To tell people it's the preferred diet, the people will discover it. What we have to do is what we try to do is prove that it's not a dangerous diet, but it's very effective for people with insulin resistance. So that's our job, I think.
So let's fast forward 5, 10, 15 years, maybe even as fast as 1 or 2. How will the education system change for the dietitians and the medical professionals when they're talking about diabetes and things like this? Because at the moment, the current, I guess, dietary prescription is a high carbohydrate diet. So when is that going to change, do you see, in the universities?
Yeah, that's going to still take a long time. I can only talk from my own university that I'm in discussions with the senior management at the University of Cape Town, because they're trying to limit some of the damage to the university's reputation on the basis of this trial and what we wrote in the book, Law of Nutrition. And they may well ask me to give lectures now to more than just the university, but to the global South African community, saying, actually, the problem with medicine is it's so concerned change, and we need to realize that we've got to see all the evidence. So that's what we have to do, is the universities themselves have to change their attitude towards education and realize that new ideas have to be embraced and tested and not just shut down. So I think it's a long process for the universities to change, but at least we're seeing some progress here.
You touched on something a couple of comments before. So we've got the science, we know this works, and we know that change is coming. But change is probably the one thing that people struggle with the most, especially if they've been eating a high carbohydrate diet that, as we know, can be very addictive for so many people. So what's your advice for people that want to change or need to change but run into these roadblocks of their own patterns or fears or insecurities or addictions? How do they change? What's your advice?
Yeah, you're quite right. I think the addiction is the real issue. The sugar addiction is what keeps most people from this diet or surviving or maintaining the diet for any length of time. And I just tell people that you've got to cut all sugar from the diet and, of course, all processed foods because they contain so much sugar. I know that there are online programs to cope with sugar addiction, but it is critical. But there's also, in a sense, a carbohydrate addiction. And I think that the way you cope with the carbohydrate addiction is getting the carbs below about 50 grams a day. Mm-hmm. and no cheat days. I think that's the other issue. You really can't afford to cheat. What I've learned from my wife is that she can eat sugar, and she'll have one teaspoon of sugar a day, and she's not addicted. I could not eat one teaspoon of sugar a day, because within a month it would be 10 teaspoons a day. Within 2 months it would be 20 teaspoons a day, because I'm highly addicted to sugar. But I haven't had sugar now for 7.5, 8 years. And so that it's slowly, slowly receding, but it's always there. So I think I used my own experience to tell people that if you are going to continue to search for sweetness, you're not going to adapt to this diet. It's either no sweetness or it's sweetness, and you're not going to really adapt to the diet. So I think that I just try to give people my personal experiences and say that, you know, this thing is, it's all or nothing. It's either on the one side or the other. And it takes a bit of discipline to get onto the good side. But the benefits are so enormous for people who have a sugar addiction, who are obese. The benefits are so enormous that they far outweigh the fact that actually you're not eating sugar anymore. The benefit of eating those foods and the feeling you get is just so trivial compared to how you feel on the low-carb diet.
I just want to ask you this question about type 2 diabetes, because you developed type 2 diabetes. What percentage of the population do you believe can reverse type 2 diabetes by adopting this way of life?
I think it depends how long you've had the disease for. And I know that going back to my past data, when I was a scientist and studying myself as a marathon runner, I was profoundly insulin resistant. And I had a fasting insulin, one measurement of 40 units. And now that on a high carbohydrate diet, we're doing high carbohydrate studies. Now 40 is at like 8 times normal. My value now is between 2 and 3, but then it was 40. At this is the age of 29, running 120 kilometers a week, being lean, I was extremely lean. And yet I had this profound insulin resistance. And then I ate this high carbohydrate diet for 33 years. I mean, that's a dead duck for developing type 2 diabetes. And of course, my father died of the disease. Mm. And that's what's motivated me more than anything, because I saw him die. And diabetes is the worst death you can have. Cancer is terrible, but diabetes is worse, because you just hang on for years and years and years, and you become progressively more debilitated and more dependent on other people. So I just want people to understand that this is a dreadful disease and can be reversed. So I got the disease because of my family history, my profound insulin resistance, and this high carbohydrate diet. My case, it's taken me 7 years to get into a situation where my glucose control is now normal. 7 years. Something of a record. I don't know how many people have persisted for 7 years and not eaten any sugar and kept a carbohydrate intake of 25 grams and got this fabulous result that I got. We do know from the Virta Health study that they took documented patients with type 2 diabetes, and 60% had dropped their HbA1c below 6.5, which means that you wouldn't diagnose diabetes in them. My HbA1c is considerably lower than that, and I wouldn't accept 6.5 as being an endpoint in any way. I think you've probably still got to go a lot lower than that. But anyway, that suggests to us that 60% of patients, if they follow it, in 1 year can reverse. And I would say that I was one of the worst cases, because I'd had the I think I'd had the condition for 5-6 years without diagnosing it, and this long history of insulin resistance. So I was able to do it. So I think people will be able to reverse their diabetes, maybe 70%, maybe 80%. But of course, I always make this point that it's not the disease hasn't gone away. You just have to continue not eating carbs. But it's because as soon as any of us return to carbs, the diabetes will just come back within a few weeks.
Well, I have a question to you about one of your passions, which is running. And I get a question of quite a lot from people that do endurance sports. And how can they continue to do the sports that they love, especially if it's endurance sports, by eating this way? Is it possible? Tell me from your background, because you talk about this in your conferences, about how to adapt to this lifestyle being an athlete.
Well, I have no question that if you're an endurance athlete, this is the diet you should be following. And there's two reasons. Firstly, the longer the event, the more fat you burn. And this way you can adapt your body to being incredibly able to burn fat. A fully adapted elite athlete will burn three times as much fat during exercise as they would if they're carbohydrate adapted. So that means that they can cover almost all the energy from fat. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing, because now you don't have to worry about all these other goos and sweet drinks during exercise. And those goos and sweet drinks, which are destroying your teeth and giving you hyperinsulinemia and damaging your body. So you can get away from all of that. That's the first point. And the second point is that the majority of recreational athletes are probably insulin resistant. They may not recognize it. It may be mild, but it's there. And what we do know is that if you've got insulin resistance and you eat a high carbohydrate diet, it gets worse all the time. The more insulin you secrete, the more insulin resistant you become. So that's a prescription for disaster, that you will develop diabetes as I did. It's just a matter of time and how much carbohydrate you eat. And the third point is that you feel so much better on this diet and you're so much healthier. So unfortunately, the scientists think that they can judge whether this diet's good or bad for an athlete, but putting the athlete on the diet and then testing them in laboratory over a single test might be a 100-kilometer time trial, cycling time trial in the laboratory. But that doesn't tell you the benefits, because the benefits are you recover more quickly, you can train. You may not be able to train at the same high intensity on some days, but the other benefits are huge. And so not being ill and not being injured, that's terribly important. And we can't measure that. So all I can say is that the only people who perhaps need more of shorter duration, say less than 2 hours. So a marathon, if you're running marathons and you're the best runners, I would never tell them to go on this diet because we don't have the evidence. But if you're not the best runner, if you're running a 3.5-hour marathon, you'll do it just as well on a high-fat diet and probably better, because you'll be a healthier human being. And in the long term, you won't have the health consequences of eating too much carbohydrate, which drives you towards insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes.
Fantastic. Tim, I want to thank you so much for being a part of this podcast today. And I'm so happy with the outcome for you and your wife and your family, and for South Africa, and for the opportunities that are going to present themselves now that this has manifested at this particular point in history. And so thank you, brother. We love you. And you have a lot of supporters over here in Australia and elsewhere around the world. But I do want to finish off by asking you the one question that I ask a lot of my guests is, what was one of your ingredients that you would like to share with the audience that you cannot live without? It's that ingredient that your recipe is so much brighter for.
Well, it's always been exercise. And I think now it's nutrition as well. But it's also having someone really close to you, like my wife, and of course my family. But those are what's critical. You know, I'm not a very sociable being. I'm very introvert and love being by myself. And so does my wife. But we complement each other so amazingly. And that's why we could make it through this trial, because just we're the same person. We're like two people rolled into one. And so I couldn't have done it without her. And I think that what I learned in life is that your decisions are so critical. There are certain decisions in life that you make which are absolutely critical. And I can see throughout my life that there were moments where I could have chosen the other one, the other choice, and I wouldn't have landed up where I am. And a lot of those choices are completely by chance, and they put you on a trajectory. For example, when I left school, I wasn't an athlete at all. I was involved in cricket and rugby and so on, and I was not an endurance athlete. And just by chance, someone said, well, why don't you try rowing? And I thought, you know, that's a good idea. And that set me on the running. That sent me on writing the book and doing the studies that I did. and meeting my wife, of course, and marrying her. Those are all chance events. And if I had chosen differently, they would have been different choices. And I think the other thing is, you know, give back. I've been very privileged in my life, and my goal is to give back to make the place a better world. And in the end, we're just part of a long chain. We're just a link in the chain. We're not the chain. We are a link in the chain. And what people remember about you and what I try to leave behind is the legacy of educating people and students to make people healthier and make them enjoy their lives better and make them less diseased. And that's kind of what I'd like my legacy to be.
Beautiful words there, Tim. And once again, thank you so much. And I can't wait to see you again in the flesh one day. And we love you. Thank you so much for your time. And we'll speak soon, brother.
Thanks so much, Pete. Fabulous privilege to be with you today. And look forward to see you next time I'm in Australia and in Melbourne. The last meal you cooked was one of the best I've ever eaten.
I've improved since then, so.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.